You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, jigsaw puzzles are suddenly a hot commodity with people looking for something to do at home. We'll find out how puzzle makers are trying to keep up with demand. First, the Wisconsin Department of Health Services says the number of confirmed COVID-19 cases in the state has now topped 3,000. More than 125 people have died. The agency says it might be 3 to 6 weeks before the virus peaks in Wisconsin and praised residents for their efforts to flatten the curve. Governor Evers' Safer at Home order is set to go through April 24th, but DHS Secretary Andrea Palm has said this week's election may create a need for a longer stay at home. Just before the election, mayors of 9 cities urged Palm to take emergency action to prevent in-person voting, but the election did go on as scheduled. Secretary Andrea Palm joins us now. Secretary Palm, thanks for taking time with us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Overall, how are we doing in Wisconsin on our efforts to slow this thing down?
So I think we are feeling optimistic about the efforts that we are all taking together to flatten the curve. Our data over the past week or so has showed our cases are not doubling as quickly as they were in the early part of March. And I think that really is a sign that Safer at Home is flattening the curve, is bending the curve, is going to help us get to a place where we're not going to overwhelm the healthcare system, and we can start to really actively manage the outbreak with the other tools that we are building up in the meantime.
Back on March 24th, when Safer at Home was rolled out, you said if we continue on our current path without implementing Safer at Home to flatten the curve, the models will show they'll likely have 22,000 Wisconsinites test positive for COVID-19 by April 8th, an estimated 440 to 1,500 deaths. Now, some people are looking back at the number and saying, well, wait, the numbers are far lower than that. We're overreacting. What do you say to that reaction to the actual numbers?
Yeah, so I think a couple things. One, I think the model projected 22,000 infections, which is different from positive cases, right? We've been constrained in our ability to test, and so we have not been testing everybody who is a probable COVID-19 case. And so there's a difference between the number of positive cases and how that reflects the actual number of infections in the state of Wisconsin. But right, our goal was to use Safer at Home to prevent that from ever happening. That's what these worst case scenario models are teaching us, are telling us, are helping us understand the kinds of interventions we need to take so that those horrible scenarios don't come true. And so, again, I think what we've started to see in our data is that we are flattening the curve, and that's really good news for the state of Wisconsin.
A big question all along, Secretary Palm, has been testing capacity, and it sounds like from announcements today we've hit a milestone when it comes to who we can test, how many tests are available. What's the latest there?
Yeah, we have been working really hard with our lab partners across the state over the last few weeks to expand capacity, right? We've had supply chain problems. We've had ability to come online with new tests, slow to get going because CDC was delayed in delivering tests to states across the country. And so we do think it's a really important moment for us as we have gotten to a place where we've got 20 labs online, where we have this capacity that well over 3,700 daily test capacity as of today, and we're going to continue to expand that. It is really important. It's an important part of our longer-term strategy for how we manage this pandemic. Testing and being able to test more folks, being able to be strategic and targeted about our testing where we have small outbreaks to help prevent them from becoming larger are really important tools for us to continue to build up as we get to a point where we want to do more surgical interventions to help us manage this pandemic until we've got a vaccine or a medical treatment that's effective against the virus.
We're talking to State Department of Health Services Secretary Andrea Palm about the state's reaction to the COVID-19 outbreak. Secretary Palm, our news team has noticed that in DHS data online, there are some multiple instances of correcting down in reporting. For example, yesterday there were 25 confirmed cases in Columbia County. Today it says 24. What might account? Is that an error in the initial data or reattributing it to another county? What might account for that kind of change?
Well, I think both of those are feasible scenarios. I think we are very conscious and very conscientious about making sure that our data is accurate, because we are, the source of truth about the state of the epidemic in the state of Wisconsin. And so we're very careful about making sure we reconcile all the information we're getting from local public health departments and double-checking and cross-checking to make sure that it's accurate. And so if we find that we didn't get it right on the front end, we do want to correct it, because it's important that we are accurate and that we make sure folks have the right and accurate information coming off our website.
You and others I know are concerned about the potential impact of in-person voting earlier this week. What are you watching for? What are you going to do to see if there's an uptick based on that over the next, I guess, week or so?
Mm-hmm. So, in-person voting or any equivalent mass gathering, right? That's essentially what it potentially was. And so we would do the same related to that as we will to the potential exposures that people might have had from standing in line or going to vote in person. And those are related to our contact tracing assets and the way we do this basic public health work around any communicable disease, around any outbreak. And that is, when we have a positive case, there's an interview with that person. Where have you been? Who have you been in close contact with? To really ascertain who else needs to be notified, who else needs to be contacted, what additional interviews need to be done, what guidance needs to be given to those people about do they need to go into isolation or quarantine, do they need to monitor their symptoms, et cetera. And that is very nuts and bolts public health work that is done, as I said, in all communicable disease outbreaks. And so whether it's in-person voting or another mass gathering, we will discover in the course of those interviews the places they have been and the ways they might have exposed other people. And so that information will come to us through the course of those interviews and through our contact tracing. And we will certainly use that information to find other people who may have been exposed and do the things that are necessary to limit the spread of the disease any further.
Now, only a few of the state's most populated counties have more than 100 confirmed cases, Milwaukee, Dane, Waukesha, and Kenosha. Some people in counties where they're only seeing, 1 to 5 cases are asking, hey, why are you shutting us down too? What would you say to people in counties where this, at least yet so far, isn't a big deal, apparently?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's a couple of things. One, I think one thing we have learned about this disease since it came into the world, and on our radar 4 months ago, is that it's highly contagious. And there's been some scientific studies published very recently that suggest for every one person infected, they transmit it to about 5.5 additional individuals. And so it's very transmissible. It's very contagious. And so, right, one of the things that is important about Safer at Home is it's protecting those places that have small numbers of cases, right? We love our lake homes here in Wisconsin. We want to be out and about across this state, and we can carry this infection with us with very mild symptoms or no symptoms at all and bring it to communities that currently don't have a lot of cases. And the other thing I would say about this that from my perspective is equally or more important is the capacity of the healthcare system in less populated areas. They don't have the same number of ICU beds. They don't have the same access to the kind of critical care capacity, infrastructure that some of the larger populated areas do. And so if we had an outbreak in one of those communities, we worry about their ability to withstand that kind of surge. And so Safer at Home as a statewide order allows us, gives us some time to build up that capacity to make sure at a regional level, at a local level, those hospitals, those systems, those communities are prepared in case they do get more than 1 or 2 cases. And that's part of what flattening the curve and Safer at Home is all about, is to give us some time to make sure our infrastructure is prepared to handle what could come.
briefly as we wrap up, you know, now we have Safer at Home. At some point, hopefully in the not too distant future, there might be a vaccine or treatments and we can get back to normal-ish. Are you working on plans for an intermediate zone? Assuming we can't do Safer at Home for, you know, a full year, what kind of things are you looking at for that interim period?
Yeah, so right to your point, without a vaccine or effective medical intervention, our tools are testing, contact tracing, and very active management to continue to protect the healthcare system and our healthcare workforce and to prevent as many people from dying as possible. And so while we are very focused on building up that infrastructure, on doing that preparation, right, it is all of our goals to get back to a place where we are living more of our normal lives, being able to do more of the things that we would do in the daily course of our lives. And so, right, when we came into Safer at Home, there were a number of steps we took before we got there. So there are different ways to set the dials and to figure out how to be able to continue to move through life in a less restricted and more surgical way. But we've got to let the data tell us where we are in the epidemic, what things we need to be worried about, how to deploy our assets. Are those assets built up enough to do that in an effective way? And so we will continue to watch our data. We will continue to look at the models, and we will base these decisions on the science and the real-time information that we have coming in every day. But obviously, we're as anxious as everybody to get to a place where we can return to more normal life. But again, to your point, until we've got a vaccine or effective medical treatment, we are going to continue to have to live very actively managing this virus.
Secretary Palm, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
Andrea Palm is the Secretary of Wisconsin's Department of Health Services. We talked to her about the latest efforts to fight COVID-19 in the state. Coming up, jigsaw puzzles aren't always the most glamorous of toys, but suddenly, with many at home looking for entertainment, we're in the midst of a puzzle revival. We'll talk more about puzzles coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, voting by mail has become a hot-button issue in the midst of the pandemic. We'll talk to an expert on voting rights about mail-in voting and other alternatives in the time of the coronavirus. First, jigsaw puzzles are having a big moment around the world. Puzzle manufacturers are struggling to keep up as we all come to the conclusion that a puzzle is what we need to spend our quarantine time doing. You can join in if you're a puzzle fan from way back or just discovering them now. Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We check in now with someone in the puzzle business to hear firsthand what sales are like. David Rolls is founder and president of Masterpieces, Inc., a jigsaw puzzle and games company headquartered in Oro Valley, Arizona. David, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me, guys.
Well, did you see a big jump in demand for your puzzles as people started to stay at home?
You know, it came on so fast and furious that it certainly caught us off guard.
Yeah, I think I saw on your website you had to shut down sales to give yourselves a chance to catch up. Do I have that right?
You know, we've slowly been taking down any drop ship or direct-to-consumer business. We do a lot of that for Fanatics, for our own website, and a number of others. But we've been overwhelmed and haven't been able to, catch up. So we've had to limit our distribution to the mostly the key retailers that are still able to operate, the Walmarts and the Walgreens and grocery, drug, that type of channel is really experiencing, you know, tremendous need for jigsaw puzzles.
Now, before this coronavirus, it seems to me that I've been hearing more and more people getting into jigsaw puzzles or back into them. Is that something you had seen even before we heard of this illness?
You know, we were seeing a nice increase, but this is certainly nothing like I think anybody has ever seen before. I was told that Amazon was completely sold out of puzzles. So, it's something we've certainly never seen before.
Do you see, now I see you sell up to 2,000 piece puzzles usually, and I usually cap out at about 500, I think. Are you seeing people get interested in these bigger, more complicated puzzles nowadays?
You know, it's hard to really get a gauge on that because, to be honest, everything is moving. So it's really tough to. I think it's tough to analyze what's really working at the moment because there is just a big demand. You know, parents are buying toys, games, puzzles of all different types for their for the kids at home, and the adults are doing the same thing. I just saw a report put out from Amazon that the number eight highest search word was puzzles for adults.
Wow.
It was ahead of disinfecting spray.
No kidding.
So, you know, it usually resides in the 100,000 number area. It went from there to number eight. So quite fascinating to see that.
Well, David, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for keeping the puzzle supply rolling.
You're welcome. Hopefully we'll keep rolling with it for a little bit and keeping people busy at home, having something fun to do while they're needing to stay put in home.
That was David Rolls, founder and president of Masterpieces, Inc., a jigsaw puzzle and games company. Now Christopher Byrne joins us, also known as the Toy Guy. He's a toy analyst, researcher, and consultant. His books include Toy Time, From Hula Hoops to He-Man to Hungry Hungry Hippos, a look back at the most beloved toys of decades past. Chris, thanks a lot for joining us today.
So nice to be with you.
What do you make of this, as we're just hearing, massive surge in interest in jigsaw puzzles during this time of pandemic?
Well, I think people are looking for things to do. It's an alternative to a screen. It is something that is a lot more contemplative and, if you will, zen-like than, say, a competitive game. But it's a chance for people to be together around a table. And it really is one of those activities that, you know, when you're focused on getting that piece of the barn or the little bit of sky or finding that corner, you're not really worrying about other things. And it's just a very good sort of mental break from everything going on.
Have we seen jigsaw puzzles rise and fall over the years?
We certainly have. I mean, they're, you know, they started in 1766 when they were, when a guy by the name of John Spilsbury created one out of maps. We've seen big booms of puzzles in 1908 when people realized they could make them at home and there were kits sold for that. And fast forward in the 80s, they were really big after say Trivial Pursuit in 83. It sort of changed a little bit of at-home entertainment. So we saw a big boom in puzzles at that time. The 60s brought a Springbok, and one of my favorite was the world's hardest puzzle, which was 500 pieces round, all white.
Yeah, that would drive me quickly into madness, I think.
Right.
Now, you just said something I didn't know about. Make your own puzzles. That sounds like it could be a big hit right about now. Is that still something people can do?
Well, you certainly can. I don't think you can do it with the same level of die cutting that somebody like Masterpieces does, but you can absolutely cut up things and it's a great lesson for children. It's great for perceptual abilities and being able to rotate something in your mind. And it's something you can do to entertain yourself. Cut up that family picture and turn it into a puzzle.
Now, Chris, I know you are interested in the serious side of play, why it's important to have fun, you know, any time. Do you see it, whether it's a jigsaw puzzle or a toy or a game, as something we should really make sure we make time for in a tough time?
Absolutely. I think it's a great time to have social play. We are physically distant from one another right now, but we need to be socially connected. And if you're at home with people, it's a very low stress, easy way to do it. As I said before, you're not competing. You're simply sharing time together, and it can open up the gates to conversations or things about whatever image you're doing, just to create that connection and perhaps a little bit of family identity.
Is there a profile demographic for jigsaw puzzles in normal times?
You know, there hasn't been. Way back in the 80s, when I was working with Western Publishing, they were a big puzzle maker at the time. And it tended to skew very female, but it was not, you know, definitive. People of all ages liked them. There's everything from preschoolers to sort of older people. I think there was sort of that 18 to like 30 range where they didn't really do puzzles, but they were some of the people when we had puzzle competitions who were really fierce at that. And that's the opposite of like the Zen puzzle thing.
I know you have a lot of play options probably around you at any given time. Do you have a jigsaw puzzle going right now?
I do not have a jigsaw puzzle going right now. I didn't think to order them before they were hard to get.
You didn't beat the rush. So do you think this is going to make a new trend now, even after the rush is over? We've discovered this habit and we'll keep doing it even when things are back to normalish?
Well, I certainly hope so. I certainly think it's a great opportunity to, as I said, to connect without relying on a screen. I do think we're going to see whatever happens economically much more home-based entertainment, much as we did in the 80s. So I do think that there may, keep some momentum for a while. It will probably plateau, as we've seen with puzzle crazes in the past. It shoots up right now. It'll plateau, and then it'll decline somewhat. But we may get some puzzlers, lifelong puzzlers out of this.
Chris, thanks for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you.
That's Christopher Byrne, also known as the Toy Guy. He's a toy analyst and researcher, author of books including Toy Time. He joined us to talk about the sudden popularity in jigsaw puzzles we're seeing lately. Well, we asked you on the Ideas Network Facebook page to share your puzzle activity. We got some pictures there. You should check them out. Grace finished a big United States of America puzzle this week. Shirley posted a picture of a heart-shaped puzzle she's working on. She says it's tough because the edge pieces don't always lock together. Sometimes they just rest next to each other, and then the next row is what holds the pieces in place. Quote, saying it's going slowly is an understatement. We heard from Diana. She posted a picture of a 3,000-piece puzzle she's working on. She says it's going slowly. And Patty says they've worked through several puzzles. Quote, we've worked several, but Mickey, Minnie, Donald, Daisy, Goofy, and Pluto are haunting my dreams. And D mentioned Stave brand puzzles. She says they're beautiful to look at, though kind of expensive. You can keep sharing your puzzle stories and your pictures over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up, Wisconsin's in-person voting got a lot of national attention this week. We'll find out how elections are being fought over and what we could do differently during this pandemic. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up Monday at 6 on the morning show, a lot of us are eager to get out into the garden this spring. Kate Archer-Kent and her guests look at what you need to know about gardening and garden shopping during the pandemic. It's tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, this week, Wisconsin was front and center for a clash of pandemic and politics. Our April 7th election went forward as scheduled, despite a messy back and forth between Governor Evers, Republicans in the state legislature, and the state Supreme Court. Some argued voters were being forced to choose between their personal safety and the right to fill out a ballot, while others said there were plenty of safe protocols in place and that people who wanted to vote absentee or by mail could have made requests to do so well in advance. Dave Daly's journalism has appeared in The New Yorker, Washington Post, and The Atlantic, among others. He's former editor-in-chief of Salon. Dave wrote a book on gerrymandering, subtitled Why Your Vote Doesn't Count. His latest, released at the end of last month, is called Unrigged: How Americans Are Battling Back to Save Democracy. Dave, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, we're still waiting for results from this week's election in Wisconsin, both the outcome itself and, as we heard earlier from our health services secretary, tracking of the possible impact it could have had on the number of COVID-19 cases. Looking in from the outside, what were some of your observations of what happened here in the state?
You know, the images from Wisconsin were truly shocking to see this week, just watching these thousands of voters outside precincts wearing masks, some of them in wheelchairs, lined up trying to socially distance, often in these lines for hours. And then the other image I think that I won't forget is the Speaker of your Assembly assuring voters that everybody was perfectly safe while wearing a mask and full personal protective gear. I can't imagine that was comforting or convincing for very many voters there.
I want to give a listen to Assembly Speaker Robin Voss working at a polling place in Burlington. He gave an interview to the Journal Times while dressed in, as you mentioned, that personal protective equipment. Here's some of what he had to say.
We are here today making sure that we do everything safely. I think it's a testament to the people who have really thought about this election. They knew what they were doing. They worked really hard to make sure that everybody who is here, the ones who are at the poll place working, the people who are coming in their cars, everybody is here safe. They have very minimal exposure. Actually, there's less exposure here than you would get if you went to the grocery store.
So the case being made by Speaker Voss and others was that we ultimately got it right and made a fairly safe voting experience for the people who showed up.
That just seems as if he probably could have made that case more convincing if he was standing there in a mask and full personal protective gear. Again, you know, the voters of Wisconsin were forced to make this decision between potentially catching a deadly respiratory disease and voting because their state's politicians forced them into that decision by refusing reasonable requests, refusing to make the kind of decision, responsible decision, that just about every other state in the nation has made to postpone elections and to expand mail-in balloting options. There was no need to force voters to the polls. There was no need to do this in person. This was a purely political exercise. It was a political power play designed, you know, largely around the importance of this Supreme Court seat, which could well be crucial as far as deciding what your state's legislative maps look like for the next decade and who has the power to draw them. It's a seat that could be crucial for the upcoming case that decides whether it will be okay to purge about 240,000 voters ahead of the November 2020 election in a state that was decided by only 22,000 votes in 2016. So this was a really consequential election, but there was no need for it to be held in person.
Talking to Dave Daly, author of the new book, Unrigged, How Americans Are Battling Back to Save Democracy, talking about voting in a time of pandemic and what it means for our elections. And Dave, since your book came out, you've also written some about the pandemic, the COVID-19 outbreak, and how it relates to elections. And one point you make is you say it highlights problems that were already there, flaws you see in our system. What kind of things do you see?
Well, I think what this really shows us is that we have a system that is going to be forcing millions of Americans to line up at the ballot box in November when we don't know what the conditions on the ground are going to look like. There could be cities and states around the country in which conditions are very similar to the ones that you all faced in Wisconsin on Tuesday. And we are not prepared for this. There's only 200 days left before the presidential election. If we want to be certain that this election is free and fair and safe and secure, there's a lot that we have to do to safeguard the vote and to expand options and to be certain that we are ready for it. I mean, what happened on Tuesday, and what happened on Monday, I think, is just as disturbing. You had a huge legal battle the day before an election about whether or not the election ought to take place the next day. Can you imagine if this is the case in states around the country? If this is replicated nationwide in November, we do not have to turn a public health crisis into a full-blown constitutional crisis. But if we can't get a handle around how we're going to conduct this election in November, that's the road we are headed down.
I want to key in on the mail-in voting idea. I want to give a listen to President Trump, first of all, in a press conference being asked about mail-in voting. Here's a listen.
You were highly critical of mail-in voting, mailing ballots for voting.
I think mail-in voting is horrible.
But you voted by
it's
mail
corrupt.
In Florida's election last month, didn't you?
Sure, I could vote by mail for that.
How do you reconcile
because
that?
I'm allowed to.
So there's skepticism among some about allowing large-scale mail-in voting, but a lot of people do it, and there's some support in both parties for it. Why is it controversial, do you think?
You know, I think it's controversial because the president would like to suggest that there is voter fraud when there's actually not. I mean, vote by mail is well established. It's used by tens of millions of Americans. It's the only mechanism used to vote in five states, including Republican Utah. It boosts the turnout across the board. It's very popular among voters. And there is very little evidence of any voter fraud. I mean, the truth of the matter is all voter fraud in this country is exceptionally rare, but it's also really rare when you're talking about vote by mail. There was an amazing study of this in Oregon, which was the first state in the nation to adopt a vote by mail. And there was a study of the hundreds of millions of ballots that have been cast since they moved in that direction. They found 14 examples of fraud out of all of those hundreds of millions of ballots. So what I worry about is that the president is being intentionally disingenuous when he's talking about voter fraud here, and that this is designed really to run out the clock, to stall, to make it really hard for us to establish the mechanisms that we need in order to have a genuinely free and fair election in the fall.
We're talking to Dave Daly, author of the new book, Unrigged, How Americans Are Battling Back to Save Democracy. We're talking about our vote in Wisconsin this week, what it tells us about our system, possible flaws in that system. Also talking about the idea of mail-in voting, allowing maybe just plain everyone to do it or everyone who wants to do it. We asked you on the Ideas Network Facebook page about the idea of mail-in voting. We heard a lot of responses from you. Here are a few examples. David wrote, 100% what just happened is criminal. Babs wrote, I think it should be all by mail, but this past election proved that not everyone received ballots. Nancy wrote, absolutely not, opens the door for an enormous amount of fraud. A different Nancy said the post office would need to be improved dramatically. Well, how about you? You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of what happened on Election Day Tuesday? What do you wish had happened if you wanted it to be different? Should we allow anyone who wants to vote by mail? Should we get rid of in-person voting altogether and just mail them in? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or join the many people posting on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Dave Daly of the nonpartisan voting advocacy organization Fair Vote. We're talking about voting by mail, voting during a pandemic, and his new book, Unrigged, How Americans Are Battling Back to Save Democracy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest about examples he's seen in other states of people pushing their government to become more truly democratic? What do you think of the idea of voting by mail? What's your reaction to the election we just had on Tuesday? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Gary is with us in Iron River. Gary, hello.
Good afternoon, guys. Say, your guest mentioned that there's been studies on fraud and no fraud has been found or very little fraud has been found. I struggle with understanding how you can find the fraud. You don't know where the fraud was. How do you know somebody didn't go to the nursing home and get the fill in the form for their mother and get somebody to sign it and send it in? I can't understand how these studies can be thorough.
Gary, thanks for the call. Dave, yeah, is it possible that there's some stealthy types of mail-in fraud, as Gary was saying?
If that's the case, all of these studies have not found it. There are laws against all of these things. There are already laws against what has been called ballot harvesting, which is what he's talking about if you go into a nursing home and try to collect ballots. There are laws against absentee ballot fraud. So it's already a felony. There are codes on these ballots that allow people to track their ballot and to replace it if it was cast under some kind of coercion. What you don't actually see are people actually using those codes and saying that there was a problem. And what I think I would also add is that it's very detectable if this kind of voter fraud is happening, right? If you look back to North Carolina and the congressional race there in North Carolina's 9th district back in 2018, there was an example of exactly what your caller is talking about. A Republican operative there went around collecting absentee ballots and filling them in. He was caught. It was really, really easy to find that kind of subterfuge. It's also really, really difficult to turn an election on that kind of fraud. If we're thinking about protecting against fraud, I think it's much more of a risk to be using, you know, hackable voting machines than it is to be talking about how we safeguard individual absentee ballots.
Thanks again for the call, Gary. We'll go to Barb with us in Green Bay now. Barb, hello.
Hello.
What do you want to tell us about, Barb?
Well, it kind of goes along with what you were just discussing. My mother is in a memory care unit in Green Bay, and I believe it was mid-March when Governor Evers said he was going to send mail-in ballots or absentee ballots to every nursing care facility in the state, and he did, but if you're in a memory care unit, most of them have signed medical power of attorney, and they should not be voting. Thankfully, the facility my mother is in called me and let me know that the ballot appeared, asked me what I wanted to do with it. And if you're not an honest person, you could vote twice. Or I had already voted. I'm registered in another state. But they just left it open. And also at that point when he said he was worried about susceptible population going to vote. If he had sent out ballots then to more people, we would have had a better turnout or more people doing balloting. I also used to live in Washington State where they do all their ballots by mail, and it works quite well. Although even though we let them know we moved when we moved back to the Midwest, the ballots followed us. So if you're not an honest person, you could potentially vote twice.
Barb, thanks a lot for the call. So Barb likes mail-in voting overall, Dave, but she worries that dishonest people could, in effect, double their vote in a couple of circumstances.
Certainly states that use all mail-in voting and that automatically mail ballots out, they have to do a really good job of protecting and updating their voter rolls. The evidence appears to be that most of those states do take that job very seriously. But I think that she brings, Barbara raises a really important point. The point is, how do you distribute these ballots? Who do they go to? And all of these are questions that we have to work out and that would be better to work out 200 days before an election than to replicate what happened in Wisconsin, in which all of these sticky questions that have to be worked out thoughtfully and carefully were trying to be worked out in a really compressed period of time. And what you end up with is an elections board that is overwhelmed with a demand and they can't get all of the ballots out. You end up with all of these problems that if we spend the next several months thinking this problem through and ensuring a safe election, we'll be in much better shape. I think there's a lot that happened in Wisconsin that we have to try to avoid this fall.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Dave Daly. His new book is called Unrigged, How Americans Are Battling Back to Save Democracy. We're talking about our Wisconsin election, the idea of mail-in voting, and more. Back to your calls. Emily is with us now in Racine. Emily, hello.
Hi there.
What do you want to bring up, Emily?
Just a couple points. Now, that after just listening to your to the last caller, I wanted to add something to what I was actually calling in about. We hear all the time, and like your guest is saying, is that mainly the people who don't believe in mail-in voting are people who the president has somehow brainwashed into thinking that the news or anything that's reported that are actually facts are fiction. So it's very difficult to have a topic that you can debate with these people, because everything that you try to tell them, they just say is fake news, even if it's something that has a factual basis that you can prove with statistics. It's like, to them, it doesn't matter. But that was the one point. The other point that I wanted to make was about how sad it was that our partisan politics in Wisconsin had people come out and vote during a pandemic. And voter suppression is very scary. Our president has blatantly stated that the Republicans know that if everybody actually voted, that there's no way they would ever win another election. Not only did it make it difficult for people in the inner city or people who tend to vote Democratic to actually go and vote yesterday, our districts are so gerrymandered here in Wisconsin that even when the percentage, we have the majority of votes in the Democratic Party, that we still were represented less because of the districts being gerrymandered.
Emily, thanks for the call. And that takes us to spend a couple minutes directly on your book, Dave. You focus on what people, if they feel like Emily does, can do about their concerns about these various parts of our voting system.
Yes. I would just say first that even the president had a panel, a commission on voter integrity and voter fraud, and that disbanded without finding any actual proof of a voter fraud. So I would like to think that the facts on this would unite all Americans. I did a book on gerrymandering and redistricting, and it was kind of a depressing book. You know, I mean, these are issues that can make you feel as if our electoral system is deeply unfair. And I went out for this new book, Unrigged, and I really wanted to find examples of Americans who were fighting back and who were working across the aisle in such a way as to fix all of these problems. I went to Michigan and I followed Voters Not Politicians, a group that was launched by a 27-year-old woman on Facebook a couple days after the 2016 election, where she was thinking about a topic that might unite everybody and settled on gerrymandering and fixing gerrymandering in Michigan. And it leads to 4,000 volunteers creating 425,000 signatures, and they go out and they create an independent commission in Michigan that wins with 60% of the vote there. I went down to Florida and I chronicled the battle there to return voting rights to former felons who lose their voting rights permanently in Florida after a felony conviction, one of the only states in America where that happened. And folks there created this amazing moral coalition of black and white, left and right, rich and poor. It was funded by the Koch brothers and also by the ACLU. And it was all about second chances and fairness and giving a civic voice back to people. And that won with 64% of the vote in a year in which Floridians elected a Republican governor and a Republican to the U.S. Senate. So there were all these examples, Ohio, Michigan, Missouri, Colorado, and Utah, all pulling together to stop gerrymandering. Alabama on felon voting rights.
We'll have to leave it there. Thanks to Dave Daly, Senior Fellow for the Nonpartisan Voting Advocacy. He's the author of the new book, Unrigged, How Americans Are Battling Back to Save Democracy. We talked to him about voting by mail during a pandemic and other challenges facing our election system. Coming up Monday on Central Time, author Ann Patchett joins the show with some great reading recommendations in difficult time, and you can let us know what's on your list. That and a lot more coming up Monday here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Monday at 8, a lot of Wisconsin's food system relies on immigrant workers. We'll find out how they're being affected in the midst of the COVID-19 outbreak. That's Monday at 8 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then how about some breakfast inspiration to start your Saturday out right? We'll talk to a Wisconsinite who's a breakfast sandwich fan. He'll share the good, the bad, and the ugly delicious sandwiches you might want to try. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.